Welcome to The Learning Curve, a show about helping kids get good grades in school and succeed in life. The Learning Curve is for parents, teachers, and students, because all of life is a learning curve, and you'll succeed to the extent that you can learn easily. Now, here's your hosts, the authors of How to Learn, How to Teach, Overcoming the Seven Barriers to Comprehension, Roger and Virginia.
How do you recognize if your child is having difficulty in school early enough to properly help? What do you do, and how do you find the professional help you need? Today we have the return of Dean Larson, the Director of Access for Knowledge Learning Centers. He has a wealth of information for you folk today on the issue of how do you recognize when your child is having difficulty and what do you do about it. So welcome back, Dean.
Well, thank you very much, and I really thank you for the invite.
Today we'd like to talk about a topic that will be perennial and evergreen for a long time. Well, hopefully, maybe not too long. It came to mind to me that parents need to learn, first of all, how to recognize the signs that their child is having problems in school, not just with grades, but are there other signs and symptoms they should be aware of? But and then after that, how would they go about choosing either a tutoring center or an after-school program? First of all, what kinds of signs should you be looking for to know whether your child is having problems?
Well, thank you. When we originally discussed doing this show and that topic, I stood back and kind of analyzed the 1,000 or so of these conversations that I've had and reflected on the way that they went. And one of the best responses to that I could think of was using the lawnmower metaphor. I have a lawnmower, and I started it up, it ran for 2 seconds, and it stopped running. I got mad, and I kicked it, and I did all the predictable things like that, and then said, well, that's not helping, so now what do? I tried it again till the battery went down. And I figured out that wasn't helping a lot, and then I said, am I out of gas? You notice I didn't check that first. Not out of gas. And then I said, well, have I got spark? Is it a carburetor problem? What's going on here? And so I started listing identifiable possibilities for how come my lawnmower wasn't starting. I stopped being mad about the time I started listing identifiable possibilities. And so carburetor, gas, spark, and so on and so forth. And then, one by one, I took the things that I knew how to do. I knew how to check the spark plug, so I pulled the spark plug and I turned it over, and lo, I had spark, so that wasn't it. In the process of taking off the carburetor, I emptied the gas tank and I had water in my gas. Ta-da, I found the solution. I was able to fix the solution and I'm off and running. If we take a look at what's going on with a student, the same way, after I get done reacting, the first thing I'll tend to do is react when I see the bad report card. And so once I get that junk out of the way and I can stand back, I can ask questions like, well, what is the evidence that my child has a problem? And so I examine the information at hand. And my advice on this is, when you examine the information at hand, don't look at it an incident at a time. Look at it over a period of time and look for trends, because we all have times when our heads get lofty.
Sorry, I just want to interrupt. And actually, that is one of the things, when I was doing my Montessori training, one of the things that we learned to do is, it's a whole course on just how to observe children and how to take notes. And the thing that is emphasized is that it's not just one time you observe the child. You observe the child over the months of time that you are with them, and you note the changes in their behavior and their abilities and such. So
and
what
their
you
development.
And their development. So what you state there is just very, very, very important. You're right.
I'll talk about the ramifications of that later, but it does have ramifications if you go running about screaming and shouting, and it will have long-term ramifications for your kid and you. So taking notes on what you're actually looking at, what's actually happening here. Well, I have a report card that is less than I know this kid can do, or it's gone down or whatever, and so I write that down. But there are other things that I will see happening. For example, is my child's behavior changing? Where he used to come home and play after school or be gregarious or be involved in stuff, is he starting to become reclusive? Now, something I would suggest is don't make any judgments based on what you're writing down. You are simply observing. We'll do the judgment piece later.
You're gathering data.
I am gathering data. So some of the behavior possibilities are mood swings, or sullenness, or a little depressed, or anxious, or he's sick a lot, or just there are a zillion different possibilities. But if I dispassionately stand back and look at them and account for them, that will lead me someplace. The other thing is, in school, particularly school issues, are my child's friends changing one way or another? Is he losing friends? Is he gaining friends? Is he moving into a group of people that are way different than his normal group? What's going on with that?
Mm-hmm.
Write it down. Don't judge it. The next piece, now I tried this with the lawnmower and it wouldn't talk to me, but it would be really a smart thing, I think, to ask the kid what's going on. Parents often really don't believe what their kids tell them. Even though kids lie a lot less about things than we think they do, what we perceive as a lie is our judgment about the activity that's going on. For example, it is very common for a child in early grades to tell me that the teacher doesn't like her. Well, what do you mean the teacher doesn't like her? As at the teacher's conference, the teacher said she liked you. And so I dismiss what my child is telling me. But if I'm just writing data, I will write down, my child has the perception that the teacher doesn't like her.
And that, of course, that affects the child's behavior in the environment with that teacher, whether it's factual or the teacher likes the kid or not.
Right. I can recall being told once upon a time, I'm not sure that I ascribe to this completely today, but at the time I was told that feelings are facts. If the kid has the perception or the feeling or the awareness that the teacher doesn't like me, consider it true, whether it's true in your estimation or not. The same thing will then be true about examining the subject matter. Okay, so you're struggling in math. What's the scoop on that? As often as not, the student won't know that one as well as they know the relationship with the teacher, but they might. And so you would like to get, and just take notes about, this is the way I see what's going on in mathematics. I just can't understand why they're making us use letters instead of numbers. And then, as we go down the list, a really good place to look for insight is asking questions of the kid about their part and how they see themselves. So what's all of this junk doing to you, kid? What's happening to you as a result of this? Are you, I noticed that you've been sick a lot lately. What's going on with that? And then listen, and listen some more.
I was going to say that's probably one of the hardest things for parents. Well, I won't say all parents, but I'm sure a majority of parents, to just actually sit and listen.
You know, what I think I would like to do, here is something that I'd like to hand your listeners, is I'll give you a 3-second course on listening.
Okay.
If you want to actually listen to your child, what you do is simply reflect back unobtrusively what they're saying to you. You make an observation and then reflect back what they say. So I will come in the door and say, man, are you looking sad? And then I'll shut up and wait them out because they can't stand not to talk. And I'm sad. Yeah, you look sad. Yeah, well, you know, somebody called me a name. Ah, that wasn't so hot, huh? Well, yeah. And I simply reflect back to them the things that I'm hearing them say until I see a change. And that takes care of the immediate discomfort, but it also gave me a whole boatload of information. Okay, and then to just getting down the list, after you've kind of heard what they're thinking about themselves, because very often, for example, kids will pick up information about themselves unwittingly that plays out in a classroom. For example, in my family, Larsons are all smart in English and they're dumb in math. We all, to varying degrees, played that out. we would dumb ourselves down if we got too smart in math, because I kind of wanted to be a Larson. I didn't care about the math thing. And so kids will pick up information about themselves and make it true, and you sometimes have to kind of fish that out of them.
So it's kind of like saying girls are never good in math or science.
I want you to know that I actually, when in the school that we have in Minnesota, my sister-in-law was working with us, and she has an advanced degree in math. Mm. And when the local math teacher told the class that girls are genetically predisposed to be not to be able to do math, she got to be a militant math teacher very quickly.
My God, it actually said genetically not programmed to do math? Oh, my God.
Girls can't do things that guys can do.
Oh.
Girls are,
there's some real idiot think going on out there, I tell you that.
Yeah.
So this second step then is actually eliciting from the kid its perceptions and understanding of what is from its point of view, and you take notes of all of this so that then you can actually make a correct analysis of, aha, what is out.
Yeah, where can I go? You don't have to even do a diagnosis with what you get, but it can lead you to who you need to talk to. The other thing that is really good about the second step of this, listening to your kid without judgment, is that you'll relieve a lot of the discomfort that your kid will be under.
Yeah.
Your kid's already believing he's a moron.
Well, you're giving your child a sounding board, basically. You're letting them just I don't want to say spew, but basically you're letting them just get everything off that is bothering them, and that right there can be a huge relief.
Kids are given huge emotional swings, but they haven't got enough life behind them to be able to reasonably rationalize what's happening to them. Because of that mystery, they can't work it out for themselves, and so you're taking the place of that and allowing them to work it out with you.
Now, are there different perspectives that you should be getting besides just your child's and what you observe?
Well, yeah, I would think that, particularly if I'm getting notes from a teacher, but not necessarily, I would go to the teacher. The whoever has the hands on this kid the most is going to have probably the greatest depth of material for our data pool. Now, I'm going to throw a caveat here. Parents are real funny about going to schools. Many of them have to get mad in order to go in and talk to a teacher. And they have to get mad because they're still remembering how awful it was to march down the hall of the principal's office and be afraid of people in authority. And that's the place that we all become 6 years old. If I can leave all of that behind and walk in and simply talk to the teacher, and the next piece that's going on, and I don't care if it's a teacher or whom, because my teacher says this is true doesn't make it true.
Mm-hmm.
I'm simply gathering data.
So in a way, you should be treating your child's teacher as a consultant. So in other words, you consult a doctor on your health, you consult a dentist on your oral health, you ask them questions, you ask them to explain things. Consider the teacher a consultant on your child.
Oh, is that cool? I wish I'd have said that, because you could have emailed me that. You know, the other thing is that, remember we were talking about the student has this emotional load about what's going on, and so I listen. The student's teacher typically takes on as a failure every time a student takes a nosedive, and they will also carry a load,
mm-hmm.
and it will color the information that they give you. So I wonder what would happen if I went in without judging and simply allowed the teacher to talk.
I bet that would be a real different experience for a lot of these teachers, because as you said, they're so used to confronting parents who are storming in, ready to just do battle.
Yeah, that's up to poor teacher's busting his butt trying to get things done for the kid.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I'm getting yelled at. And so what happens there is any of the emotional baggage or any of the prejudicial kinds of baggage that that teachers would have about a student get taken out of the context, and suddenly we're simply talking about data, what's actually going on with the kid. The other places that I would go with that is if your child has seen the school counselor or has seen the school psychologist or something, of course you're going to want to go and check them in the same way with the same caveat.
I see here that after you have gathered your data, so in other words, what you've observed, what you hear from your child, what you hear from teachers or others that are close to your child, you have listed here what are the possibilities for change. What do you mean by that?
When you're doing this, one of the things that's always helpful, because it does keep the possibilities in front of you as you're gathering this data, and you have reminded yourself not to either align and agree with an opinion about it or a point of view, or react and resist to a point of view about it. You're just taking data. When I do that, I can ask the question, what are the possibilities for change here? What needs to happen in order to change? And if I keep my ear open during the entire process, things will start popping up, like discovering that I had water in my gas as I was exploring the carburetor.
What if the change is something that the child doesn't necessarily want to have happen? Suppose it's a change that you want to see, but maybe it's not what the child wants. What would you recommend?
That's the place that I talk to the parent, and I say, okay, Dean, in my point of view, I think that my kid should be this. What am I imposing on my child? Does my child have to uphold the name of the family? Is that what I'm expecting? I see my child is hurting and it causes me to hurt, so do I need to change my child so that my child won't hurt my feelings? What's going on? And it's time for a little reflection.
Yeah, parents do superimpose on their kids things that should not be superimposed. That's a really brilliant point, Dean.
It goes on for generations.
Yeah.
Bear in mind that just like we talked about the child, there is a separate and hidden set of emotional nasties that go along with being a parent. I'm the one that's responsible for fixing all this stuff. I don't know what to do. I'm scared my kid's hurting and I'll do something wrong. I got all this going on, so you may want to listen to you as well.
For how long should a parent be compiling this data? In other words, are we talking about 6 months long, 3 months, 2 months? How long?
By the time a parent finds out that there's a problem with the kid, the problem has been going on for 3 months. And to wait longer probably would add some other problems to it. So you'll want to move along. I can, without acting impulsively, in a week, acquire some really good data. And I can probably do it in 4 hours if I had a gun to my head. But give yourself the time to comfortably gather something so that you're going at it with enough information.
So in other words, maybe about a month of observation of your child, and during that time you're talking to teachers, and maybe towards the end you're talking to the child?
Right, and something I should bring up at this point is that sometimes in the process of gathering the information, you actually resolve the problem. The kid starts feeling better about himself because he had a chance to talk to somebody. Ooh, file that one away. The teacher feels better because she had a chance, somebody actually listened to what she had to say. Oh, file that one away. Gosh, you know, it isn't really as bad as I thought it was when the teacher is looking. And so in the process of doing that, the old elephant in the living room thing, if we actually look at the elephant, we can figure out how to get it out.
I see here that in part of the resolution to the problem or the possible problem, I noticed that you have parents go through a medical checkoff first. And I find that very interesting because, you know what, I never thought of that. You need to make sure that you have checked off any possible medical problems.
When I was tutoring actively and teaching, and I would get a student who was struggling in a class like social studies. There's nothing to struggle in social studies unless it's a boredom thing. There's nothing to struggle in, and so I'm saying, okay, so what's going on with this? And then I discover that the child is only hearing every fourth word. Oh, I guess I could figure out how come that kid isn't getting it.
Well, okay. He's got poor eyesight and can't see what's being put up on the board and tricks like that.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I watch for squinters. Teachers are generally trained for that, and schools tend to have audiologists, but kids fall through cracks. And also, if the tests are a year apart, kids change so dramatically, especially the younger one, and so quickly, that a problem that wasn't there last week can be there this week.
Well, what's interesting is that it was in fourth grade that my parents realized that I needed glasses, and my I think my grades were going down or something like that, or maybe I wasn't paying attention. I can't quite remember what brought it about, but they went and had my eyes checked. And I usually, every year, we would get the eye exam done, but I got my eyes checked. Turns out I was not able to see what was up on the board because my eyes had changed so much.
And it's the nature of growing children. Their bodies change. You know, how long does it take a flower to grow up? Not very long. We're a lot more complex than flowers, but we grow at that kind of rate, especially when we're talking up through middle school. It starts tapering off a bit in high school. I put pediatrician in there because there are some other things that I would suggest could stand to be addressed, and that goes under the heading of any allergies. Is this kid taking a medication? There are some medications for things that have been diagnosed as ADD and ADHD and so on. Some of the medications that kids take show up in their capacity to learn math, but not so much in other things. And so I always kind of have my ears open to, what's going on with this? So then I would check with the doctor and find out what the medication is, and we can discuss the counterindications and stuff with the doc. And he may prescribe something different, or she might say, get that kid in here and let's take a look.
We've been able to check off all the medical possibilities of why the child is not doing well, and we come down to the fact that they just need a little extra help. They need, whether it's somebody to sit with them and explain it step by step. How does a parent now choose? I mean, there are so many different ways, so many different paths they can take. How do they choose the path to take for their child?
Once you've acquired that information and you find out that, you know, for a long time my kid has become less and less sure of himself in this subject matter, and he won't raise his hand anymore according to the teacher, and I'm looking at these behaviors and stuff, and I'm saying, you know, it sounds like he could use a boost academically to deal with this stuff, and I bet you that would help with some of the confidence and that sort of stuff. And so it's at the point that I'm having conversations like that with myself that I'd say we need to go and look at some academic stuff. In terms of what's available in the community, there are, in many communities, particularly true of cities, although some smaller communities this is also true, there will be a variety of services available. One of the most visible might be the large national chains that advertise on TV. You can see them because they're on the street corner in a mall or something. They will haul out record of smashing success. They have had wonderful success with kids. They have available huge resources. They will typically do in-house diagnostic testing, which is not to be confused with sending your kid to a psychologist to have them checked, but in-house, so they know what they're going to do, diagnostic testing, and then they will pick up on, it's an additional set of eyes picking up on, wait a minute, there's something going on here, and they'll help you make a referral. Very often, they will have a fixed program of learning, and all of the kids will go through the program. My point with the fixed programming is that it's fixed, and to some degree, they can change it to accommodate a student, but the success that they've had is the fact size fits all.
So basically, it's almost like going back to school, because that's what they're doing. They're doing cookie-cutter children in public schools, so these places are doing cookie-cutter children in tutoring centers.
And it can be, and it's not quite the same degree as school, because the numbers aren't as noticeable. You know, they haven't got 35 kids to one teacher. So that the teacher is able to spend more time with a student and be a little bit more, but the actual process of learning tends to be somewhat fixed. This is more true for remedial work than it is for tutoring, but even in tutoring that happens a little bit. That is not a negative statement, that just is the way that they do that, and as I said, they can haul out files of enormous number of students that have had their lives change as a result of doing that. So that's kind of what the larger change looks like. One of the things that is really a positive for them is that fixed programming they have put together works for the bulk of people. And so you stand a decent chance of having your child progress in their program just based on that experience. And they also have lots of resources available. Now, some places don't have them, but there are smaller and local centers available, and even in places where those larger centers exist, you'll find a real diversity of local centers. Some of them have kind of a similar look to that large center, where you come in and they may do prescriptive testing and they will have a program that's fixed and so on and so forth, but it's on a smaller scale, and they often seem more personal than the larger ones, simply because there would be fewer kids in the building.
So does that mean they're actually able to really tailor the type of tutoring that they give to your child?
Okay, so I'm going to go out on a limb here and say any tutoring center of any size has the ability to tailor the information to a specific student. It's not always terribly expedient and cost-effective.
And one hears a lot about having individual tutors, for example, rather than going to the big corporate enterprises, finding a local...
A local college student.
Or local retired teacher or something like that who wants to continue doing it. How do you evaluate the comparative use or benefit of going either route?
The first thing I would do if I were looking at an individual tutor, and by the way, there are companies that broker individual tutors.
Oh.
And along with it, they have kind of vetted the tutor, and they may even carry insurance and so on and so forth. So that's not a bad place to look. I would always interview the tutor first. I might vary from what someone else would look for. I'm less interested in how much the tutor knows about the subject matter than I am with what the relationship skills are with the child. I can look it up, but if I haven't got the relationship and communication skills with the child, it doesn't matter what I know. I had occasion to have a cup of coffee down the road at the coffee shop the other day, and sitting there was a college kid on one side of the table and this guy probably in his 40s on the other side of the table. He had a computer, she had a computer, and they were working on equilibrium constants in chemistry. So I was listening. I was fascinated because it was kind of like being able to sit in my own office and watch me. She was pushing the edge of what he had in his head, and so he had chemistry sites open and a textbook next to him. However, everything that he explained to her came alive, and she was able to go back into, now remember, she's already been in class, and she has that in her head. So when he started talking about, you know, we do this in squared because there are two moles of this doing that to the other thing, and she goes, ah! And you can see the light bulb come on, and you can see her confidence go up, and this guy was wonderful. The thing that I would say in every place, and parents are not accustomed to doing this, and that is trust your gut. If you don't like him, don't hire him. I don't care what else is going on. I don't care if everybody in the universe likes him. If you don't like him, that's the only one that counts. The second thing is if your kid doesn't like him, don't go there.
Now, I know that when you're talking about individual tutors, sometimes they'll come to your house and sometimes you'll meet in, I don't know, like maybe a library or a coffee shop, like you talked about. I guess it's a matter of the parents' level of comfort. Is there one that you would recommend over the other?
What I would do is, as we're having this conversation, slide into the shoes of the student. Would you like to be tutoring, having your mother peeking around the corner?
Probably not.
Okay. If the answer to that was, yeah, it wouldn't make any difference, tutor at home. It's comfortable. It's fun. You know what's going on. If there's an element like that, or there are a lot of kids and it's distracting at home or something like that, then I would say an out-of-home site might be better.
Is there a website or is it a Google kind of search that people can go to locate the tutoring centers or the individual tutors? Where can parents go and find these types of resources?
When I'm doing my other thing, which is setting up learning centers, I typically do a demographic search, and it would be approximately the same thing as that. And so I'll get on and I will do a search for like math tutor or something like that, and you will get 17,000 response. But bear in mind that the way those websites or the way those searches operate is the one with the most hits is at the top. So take the top bunch and go down them and explore some websites. Trust your gut.
Right.
Write down a list of five of them that meet your price range. They typically do not list prices. You almost have to go and sit and have the interview to find out the price.
So in other words, then you would look for the operating hours, I guess, so that's convenient for your child.
Operating hours, location.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that I want to have my kid waiting in the parking lot of the convenience store that was held up twice last week. You know, just the common sense stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I get it down there, and all of a sudden I've got five places that I could go visit.
Now, you've just opened up a new center yourself, haven't you, Gene? The Access for Learning Centers. You've got three now. Is that the idea? Where are they located? Just let our listeners know.
In Fergus Falls, Minnesota, it's listed as Twin Oaks School and Learning Center. That one's a little different than the others. It's both a school and a learning center. And Access for Knowledge, Spark Hill in Spark Hill, New York. And the director there is an awesome friend named Christine DiDomenico. And the newest one, and they're having their grand opening this Saturday in Fort Collins, Colorado, is run by an absolutely phenomenal woman named Mary Dravis Parrish, who has been tutoring tots or tutoring kids for something like 25 years. And it is just magical walking in to either of these people. They both have a vast experience with working with kids, and it's just delightful. I like my job, can you tell?
That actually brings up another question. That's a very interesting question. Tutoring for tots. How young? I mean, at what point do you start tutoring, getting your child tutored? A tot seems like it's pretty small.
I'm going to call it tutored. I have tutored kindergartners and even younger. Have you noticed that you just don't go to day school anymore or day care and play with blocks? They make letters and they make mm-hmm. numbers, and it's assumed you'll be able to write the alphabet by the time you're this old or that old. And some kids are unable to do that, so everybody panics. I work with a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old. I love doing it because I can do some things with them that will last their whole lifetime, one
right.
of them being telling the kid there is not a thing in the world wrong with you.
Yes.
Yeah, and that
yes.
you can accomplish anything. Yeah. You know, it's very important to let them have the big wins when they're young so that they can pursue attaining what it is that they want in life.
It's a little more difficult when you catch it at the age of 16.
I remember when we had you as a guest on our show a couple of months ago, Dean, that you have a whole rather unique and we found very worthwhile and wonderful philosophy behind your Access. You call it, I know your website is accessforlearning.org, but you call your centers the Access for Knowledge.
Access for Knowledge has the assumption that learning is involved with facilitating a child to know something he already knows. So we go Access for Knowledge. Teaching implies imposing, and facilitating implies allowing the child to bloom. And that works in academics enormously well.